The reading is from James chapter 4, starting at verse 13. You will find this on page 215 of the New Testament sections of your Bibles. James chapter 4, verse 13. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and get gain. Whereas you do not know about tomorrow. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live, and we shall do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Whoever knows what is right to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. Three or four brief notices before we begin. First, good news if you meant to but forgot to order lunch today. There are a few sandwich lunches left. Order them at that table at the bottom of the steps, please. And there are plenty of soup lunches to be ordered at the tables over there immediately after the service. If you can stay and have time for a lunch, do please do so. Then secondly, if you'll turn over the hymn sheets, you'll see one or two notices there. Firstly, one about Channel 5, and that's the name we've given to our new work to try and reach younger city workers on Thursday lunchtimes at St Andrews. There are cards about that on the back chest. Do please take one if it'll apply to you. And if you'd be willing to come and help us pray for that project the Thursday before it starts, well then please come then on the 29th of September. Then Dick has a short notice there. If someone can help him, he'd be grateful. And finally, you'll see there a notice about basic facts. That's a 6-week course on Wednesday lunchtimes for people who want to take further what they hear on these Tuesday series. If that's you, then do just fill in the form at the bottom and hand it to a steward or put it in one of the boxes on the way out. Well, back to James chapter 4. And welcome to this series called Question Time. It was many years ago when I was teaching, but I can still remember it quite clearly. It was about the third week of the autumn term. They were 2A6, which was a near remedial class, and the subject was meant to be French. And one of the kids put his hand up and asked what was, of course, the crunch question. Even I could work that out. Sir, why do we have to learn French? Well, if you'd heard their English, you could see it was a fair question. I did my best. Well, of course, you'll find it very useful. If you ever go on holiday in France, it'll be useful to be able to speak the language. Unfortunately, some bright spark in row two was up to that, and he said, well, sir, we went on holiday last year in France, and they could all speak English. So I was reduced to sheer materialism and self-interest, and I said to them, well, of course, remember, any O-level pass is worth an O-level pass, whatever the subject. Some realistic lad in row four put his hand up and said, but sir, none of us is going to get O-level in French. So we just did it because sir said we were doing it. Now, you don't have to be a good teacher, and I'm not, to realize that it is small value giving someone the right answers if they persist in asking the wrong questions. And though we've called this series Question Time, it's not going to be looking at the questions that we often fling at God. Though there's a right and proper place for us to look at those. Now, this is actually a series the other way round. It's looking at the questions, or at least some of them, that God has for us. And if some of them scratch where we don't itch, well, that's deliberate, because it's true that we ought to be itching there. Think about these, in other words, and we may discover that we're getting closer to the answers about life and God and ourselves. Now, in case anyone has fears, let me hasten to add that I hate exams. I can still remember the sense of relief when I finished the last one I ever took, and this series will not be like an exam. It's not academic. We're not looking for theory answers. We don't even want, by way of answers, what I think I believe. Now, how I actually live is bound up in the answers to these questions. That, of course, is why Christianity is often uncomfortable for us. We won't be able to answer these questions in the lunch hour and then just get on with life as before. Lastly, by way of introduction, let me say this. I'm discovering, as I've started work on them, that these truly are questions for everyone, whether you come here this lunchtime as Christian or not, whether you're a convinced believer or just a seeker after the truth, whether you've heard about St. Helens and so you've come, or you're just here to appease a friend, whether you're a regular churchgoer or you came to look at the brasses and it's rather embarrassing to walk out now, it doesn't matter too much. I think we'll discover that these questions are more universal than we might imagine. They're certainly far less selective than I thought when I chose them. So enough by way of introduction. Let's illustrate it all by looking at our first question. What is your life? And come and see the way James approaches this question. James chapter 4, verse 13. See, he begins with what we can only describe as very common talk. The first thing that struck me is how ordinary this kind of talk is. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we'll go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and get gain. Now, we all speak like that, don't we? You'll hear this conversation in every office every week. I mean, imagine the boardroom. Now, shareholders would be indignant if they did not talk like this. If there were no plans and no forecasts. Of course, round the boardroom table, they're making their plans. They're deciding that they'll open a branch here and invest capital there. Someone's suggesting it'll take 12 months to turn this business round. Someone's asking, what are the budgeted profits? And someone's got the answer. Or if it's more homely, imagine yourself back by your fireside. Won't be long before you have to light the fire again. It won't be long before someone's persuading you to start planning next summer's holidays. And the conversation will go something like this, won't it? You know, next year, dear, the children will be old enough to manage on their own. You'll have got another pay rise. There'll be the bonus. We could take that holiday in. And the exotic cruise is yours. Or you're a newcomer to the city. Man or woman, it doesn't matter. No doubt when the company hired you and lured you into their embrace, they already encouraged you to start thinking ahead. They showed you the next rungs on the ladder that could be climbed. You're dreaming, perhaps, and perfectly fairly, of your rise to the top. The Dockland flat, the Porsche. Well, if you get the first, you may find the second is vandalized, but it doesn't really matter. You get the gist. Actually, of course, even here at St. Helens, we're talking precisely the same way. We have a major staff meeting this afternoon, and I realized as I looked at this passage again last night and this morning that I am already planning for the year ahead, and I'm thinking about starting Channel 5, and others are thinking of strengthening the work here and doing something there, exactly as in verse 13. It is so common, so ordinary. The surprise is that James is bothering to draw attention to it, because that's what he's doing. Come now, he says. Here, you, the ones talking like that. And our heads jerk up. We say, oh, what's the matter? What's the fuss? I mean, to speak of life with this kind of certainty, and we'll discover that's what he's getting at, is a very ordinary thing to do, isn't it? And of course, the man of verse 13 is very certain about his life. He's got the time. There'll be a market. He'll make a profit. He talks a good life. Oh yes, to speak of our lives and to think of them, to assume that we have control, why, that is very common talk. What is your life? What I make of it. Well, says James, if that's the way we commonly talk, we better face a shocking reality. Because that's the second thing he has to say to us in this paragraph. Look at verses 14 and 15. James wants me to wake up to a shockingly different world from the one I've been talking about in verse 13. Here is a world that's marked by, well, verse 14, ignorance. You speak of going into such and such a town and spending a year there and trading and getting gain, whereas you don't know about tomorrow. You've planned for a year, but you're actually ignorant of tomorrow. I mean, honestly, I don't know what it'll bring, do I? For someone it'll be redundancy. For someone it'll be illness. For someone it'll be a fortune. You don't want me to remind you about what anniversary comes on October the 19th? Not too many people knew what that Monday morning was going to bring in advance. Last year? Yet, of course, we don't live as if we're ignorant. Companies and individuals are investing next year's profits, which are assumed, in this year's loan. Remember that brilliant story Jesus told of the rich farmer, the man who'd got so many crops he didn't know what to do with them. And he decided he'd pull down his barns and build bigger ones, and he'd got it all planned out, and he said, now eat, drink, and be merry. I've got everything saved up for my retirement. The one thing he didn't know, that the moment his plans were complete would be the precise moment he'd no longer be around to enjoy them. Now, the shocking reality of life, says James, is that it's marked by ignorance. What is your life? Something that's marked by frailty. Look how he answers his own question. For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. Now, that's not very flattering. But we don't need to think too hard to see that there's all too much truth in it. And we keep supposing our life is substantial and solid and foursquare. We try and surround ourselves with whatever is intended to make it look that way. The salary, the house, the car, the holiday, the office, whatever it is. But what is your life? You're a mist. Something very insubstantial, he says. Something a bit like a vapor, like the steam out of the kettle that we boil for the endless cups of coffee. You know, and the click switch goes, and a few minutes later that steam's gone with it. Which appears for a little time. We're very transient. In so many ways, life is just a passing thing. You know, those grey cells that everyone keeps talking about in our heads. Well, some bright medic told me that the moment I had most grey cells in my brain was the moment I was born. We've all apparently been losing them ever since. Now, when you look around you, you realize how remarkably many some people must have had to still be around and still losing them. You know, I keep congratulating myself as every year goes by. But more seriously, because it is a serious thing, isn't it, that life is such a transitory event. I've still got vividly etched in my mind the rawest grief I think I've ever come across. I was rung up about an hour and a half after someone had died in a house near us, and I'd gone round to visit. He died of a heart attack that morning. And his wife was still sobbing uncontrollably. Her eyes were red. Her hurt was almost visible. And she could just get out phrases in between her sobs. And the story became clear. They'd just moved into this guest house. They'd been planning it for some time. They were working out their next 10 years and how they were going to do it up and what they'd make from it and how they could retire. He'd got up that morning, felt a pain in his chest, slumped back on the bed, and he was gone. "It's so unfair," she gasped. And it must have felt like that. But there's a sense in which, of course, in reality, it's just what life is for all of us. You are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. Gone without a trace. That may seem very harsh, but will we be remembered? Few of us are. I mean, 20 years after you've left, will they know of you in the office? Do you know who occupied your desk 20 years ago? No, someone who was just a mist and appeared for a little time and has since vanished. How frail life is. Our reality, says James, is that we don't know much about life. It's a very frail thing. Reality, says James, is that we ought to live our life in dependence. That's the hallmark of verse 15. If we face up to reality about life, we'll talk like this. Instead of talking like verse 13, we'll say as we ought to say. Look at verse 15. If the Lord wills, we shall live and we shall do this or that. See, the frailty he's highlighting isn't meant to lead me to think that life is all meaningless. It's meant to drive me to a dependence on my maker and my sustainer. Now, please look very closely at verse 15. I don't want people to misunderstand what's being said this lunchtime. It is not planning ahead that is under fire. It is not planning ahead that's under fire. Look at verse 15. The person who's speaking properly, as they ought to speak, is also planning ahead. If the Lord wills, we shall live and we shall do this or that. Yes, don't worry, there's still a need for Philofaxes. James understands we have to look and think ahead. The Bible never condemns that. Look again. It is not ambition that's under attack. It's not the fact that he planned to make a profit. No, if the Lord wills, we shall live and we shall do this or that. There's nothing wrong with good goals. What is under attack is the self-confidence that smacks of being master of my own destiny. If I can put it this way, it's not what's in the diary of verse 13 that's wrong, it's what's not there. There is no trace of the humble spirit of dependence. I mean, if verse 14 reminds us that the content of tomorrow is uncertain, verse 15 tells us that even the very existence of tomorrow and ourselves is uncertain. See, remember, in Bible terms, life isn't like the circle line. Tomorrow doesn't just keep on coming round and round and round and round. It's much more like the central line. Had a beginning and it has an end. Once there was no yesterday, one day there'll be no tomorrow. Now, what is your life? A mist, says James. A mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. So you ought to speak and think in these terms: if the Lord wills, we shall live. Now again, please do James the justice of not treating him superficially and not imagining that he thinks if we glibly add, oh well, the Lord willing or God willing, on the front of all our sentences, that makes everything all right. He's not trying to encourage pious platitudes. He doesn't want us to stamp the Latin equivalent DV on the folder of our life and think that that makes it acceptable if the contents and the ideas and the attitudes are just the same as before. No, he's not encouraging a shibboleth, is he? He's not attacking planning ahead. He's really urging us simply to be humble. What is your life? Common talk, common thinking says, well, what I make of it. But the shocking reality is that our lives are far more fragile plants than we like to imagine. So we'd be wise to think that way and speak that way and have as our attitude, if the Lord wills, we'll live and do this or that. Common talk. The shocking reality. Now, in case we don't face up to his reality and his consequences, notice before we go his stinging verdict. That's verses 16 and 17. As it is, he says, you don't speak as you ought to. You boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Aren't those strong words? See, I began when I came to verse 13 thinking, this is so ordinary. And James says, it's so arrogant. And yet it was so ordinary. Verse 13 is very common talk. That's the punch of this paragraph. If I'd begun at the bottom, I'd have never realized how deeply involved I am in this arrogance and boasting. But when I'm brought back to face up to New Testament Christianity, I see just how down to earth and true to life it is. There's nothing airy-fairy about this Christianity, is there? It's the world of verse 13. It's the world of the brash, confident businessman that has got its head in the clouds. James's approach to life is all too real. My sister moved house over the summer. She's moved to a very nice house out in the Hampshire countryside. And I'm told that you can only see a couple of other homes from where she lives. One of them belongs to someone who used to work in the city. Apparently he was working here, doing well for his company, and he went over to Japan and he clinched a major deal for them in Tokyo. When he got back, he discovered that his firm had been taken over. There were now two people doing his job, and he drew the short straw. See, today, he had a home, a mortgage, and a good job. Tomorrow, he'd clinched a major deal and had no income. That's reality. The last time I spoke on this passage happened to be on a Sunday. Got back home Sunday night, Monday morning, children and I had hardly sat down to breakfast, and the phone went. I heard my mother had cancer. Now, what is your life? Come now, you who say today or tomorrow we'll go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and get gain. Is he to view life as if we're the masters of our own destiny? As if we can neglect the true God and think as if he didn't exist, to assume that life is our right and complain it's unfair when it's taken from us, to assume that our choice is the only deciding factor, to assume that we have it in ourselves to make a success. That's to live in a make-believe world. That is living in fantasy land. Worse, says James. That's to participate in the greatest rebellion of all time, because it's to play at being God. Such an ordinary way of speaking and thinking, and yet so desperately arrogant. See, says James in verse 16, we boast in it. We put out prospectuses about our future achievements as if nothing could stop them once they're planned. That boasting's evil. Literally, it's of Satan. Because ever since Genesis 3, it's the game he's been trying to get me to play God, or in other words, to replace God. It is still the most natural thing in the world for me to do. See, to think this way, to speak this way, to live this way, is, verse 17, to have myself classified as a sinner. As one who's in rebellion against God. I may be the most unassuming, mouse-like person there is, and yet to talk and think like verse 13, to pose as the controller of my own life, is arrogant boasting. But so normal we don't notice it. This has been the shock for me. James has picked on what I've always regarded as a trivial feature, my forgetfulness of my utter dependence on God, and he exposes it as the hard core of my pride. And it couldn't be more lethal to me. Look back to verse 6, will you, of chapter 4? See how lethal this is? Here's the truth about God. Chapter 4, verse 6, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. That's the way God always works. It's the way he always will, so I mustn't think I'll be an exception. And I daren't be found, dare I, living life as if I'm my own God. If the reality of what James is saying is dawning on me, if I understand that he's got the truth, then I daren't go on talking and thinking like verse 13, because, well, if I know what's right to do and fail to do it, for me that's sin. And sin disqualifies me with God. So there's our question for this week. What is your life? No philosophizing, no theory answers only, not even what you think you believe. Serious examination. How do you live it? See, I believe James speaks right across the board to us. He didn't begin, did he, with, "Come now, you who say, I covet a million. Or I covet this man or that woman, or I covet the killing I'll make on this insider deal. For you, that's sin." No, he says, "Come now. You who say something as ordinary as, today or tomorrow we'll go to such and such a city and trade there and get gain." What do you think your life is? You're a mist. Don't worry, this has been an awfully morbid beginning, hasn't it? It will get better, I promise you. We'll discover that we're a remarkably precious mist, an incalculably valuable one to God. But nevertheless, there's truth. You and I are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. Have you come to terms with it? I don't know whether it's easier to come to terms with when you get older. But have I got a right estimate of myself? We were on a holiday this summer. Claire was reading a book and I asked her what it was about, and she said it was about men, and she told me that she discovered men have a midlife crisis as well. And I asked her what she meant, and she said, "Well, you discover you're not as fit as you were on the squash court, and your hair and your looks go, and you've lost your appeal to younger women, and men have a problem. You've got to come to terms with that." I said, "Tell me in a decade." James told me, "You're a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes." You ready for that? It's reality dawning. Ought I to be turning over the page of the hymn sheet and signing up and getting down to the basic facts? Let's pray. God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Our sovereign God, have mercy on our natural arrogance. So a dependence on you deep in our hearts and minds, we pray, that we might discover your grace for Jesus' sake. Amen.